I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. How far is too far when calling out even egregious acts of free speech? Plus, the Washington Bar Association makes a final decision on whether it will investigate Attorney General Bob Ferguson's conduct before the November election. And a former union leader in Seattle says small businesses that can't afford to pay their workers more don't deserve to be in business. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback, our final live show of the week. Seems like it's going to happen. It seems like now I've made a bet already once. I'm not betting on any more timelines, but all signs are pointing to President Joe Biden likely dropping out of the 2024 presidential race. Nothing is confirmed yet, but when you start seeing these leaks from the highest ranks of the Democratic Party, Democrats have discipline, something Republicans often lack. They have discipline within their ranks and in their caucus. And Nancy Pelosi, as an example, she is not going to allow a private conversation she had to be leaked unless she wants it leaked. And that's what's happening now. So you've got Nancy Pelosi behind the scenes apparently trying to convince Joe Biden that there is not a path to victory for him. Obama doing the same thing. There have already been, Adam Schiff came out publicly and said he thinks that Joe Biden ought to step aside. Everyone's talking about this Axios article. Behind the curtain, top Dems now believe Biden will exit. And the reason why that article is getting a lot of attention is because they're putting a timeline on it. I mean, they think that this weekend, Joe Biden, who's currently isolating because he has COVID-19, they think that he will somehow formally drop out of the race this weekend. Again, I've believed this before. I've been wrong. But when you've got Obama and Pelosi and the leaders of your own party saying, like, look, regardless of what you think about your health and your capacity to be able to move forward, the numbers show that you can't win. I just don't see how he stays in the race any longer. So I don't know how they're going to play it. Maybe they're going to say, oh, COVID, you know, really did a number on him. And he's going to come out and say, I'm not getting any younger. And it's time for me to step aside and pass the torch to Kamala Harris. And that's who it will be. I've become more convinced. I thought for a while they'd bring in some new blood. I think it's too late for them to do that. And also, Donald Trump is just on this like fierce trajectory. And you're not going to have someone like Gavin Newsom who wants to come in and just be a patsy to be the almost like the disposable napkin to say, OK, we're just going to put someone up. We know they're going to lose. And then he ruins his chances of being able to mount a credible campaign for the presidency in 2028. So this is kind of like, I mean, it's a bad situation for Democrats, but it's their way to get rid of Kamala Harris is to put her up as the presidential candidate in a situation where she probably can't win. And I don't even know who will agree to be her vice president. And again, I realize it's not official yet, but let's read the tea leaves here. Who would agree to be her vice president? It would have to be, I heard that there was some pressure for Pennsylvania's Democratic governor, Josh Shapiro, to do it, which I think he'd be great. We just complimented him on the show the other day for how he handled and his tone and tenor after the assassination attempt on Trump. But he's a rising star in the party. He's not going to take his rising star and distinguish it on a failed endeavor. So I think Kamala Harris is going to have a hard time finding someone credible who wants to be your vice presidential running mate. What they'll probably do is choose someone who's at the end of their political career because she kind of needs that balance, right? Old white guy, sure. Yeah, like Biden, but someone, you know, who's functional. Because one of the biggest knocks, and it's a fair one against Kamala Harris, is she doesn't have the experience and she's shown that she's just not an effective communicator. She doesn't have a grasp of the issues. So to counterbalance that, you're going to want to pick someone who's been in politics for a long time. And that makes sense here because then they don't have further ambitions. I think it has to be someone who's old enough, but in politics long enough where they don't have ambitions to run for the presidency at some point and, you know, are willing to take one for the team, for lack of a better phrase. So I wish Biden the best. I certainly, you know, at his age and in his condition, yeah, COVID would be a concern for someone like him. So we'll see what happens over the weekend. But these leaks are not accidental. I just fail to see how President Biden stays in the race any longer. And you've got now less than a month, about a month until the Democratic National Convention. And the Republicans just nailed it, honestly. Their convention has been great. We'll see how Trump's speech is tonight. But what a mess for Democrats. Has there ever been, somebody tell me, because I'm not as aged, as experienced as some of you who might be watching. I was born in 88. So I'm curious if there's ever been a time in modern history where both parties seem pretty like confident of the outcome of the election, where the other party's like, yeah, we're probably going to lose. I'm sure there has been. I just, you know, and my memory only goes back so far. So,
well I kind of think that was the Obama thing, right? Because I mean, I don't know that a lot of people had faith. Wasn't it Huckabee, right? So I don't.
No, it wasn't Huckabee.
Not Huckabee. No, Romney.
Yeah.
But I don't know that.
I think
wasn't a real, you know, solid candidate, and that's why the Chris Christies and the other ones dropped out of that, because they were like, we're not going
to
win this.
I mean, certainly not to the extent it is now. This Especially is quite the disaster. But I'll also say Republicans cannot rest on their laurels. They can't convince themselves like they did in 2022 that it's going to be a red wave, and then they lost miserably. So you have to keep the momentum up. You can't just say, oh, we're going to win, no big deal. So we'll see what happens there. Somebody said for Democrats, Bill Clinton to be the vice president for Kamala Harris.
I think that's
a terrible idea because he's also getting up there in age. So maybe not quite that retired.
But again, why would you want to go out like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. All right. So I just wanted to mention that off the top. Moving on to some local news, statewide news. A couple things I wanted to follow up on. So we mentioned on the show yesterday that just a couple days after there were calls to tone down political rhetoric against not just former President Trump in light of the assassination attempt, but also against just everyone and political candidates in general. Nick Brown, a candidate for attorney general in Washington, released his first ad of the cycle. Here's a clip from it.
It's a real threat. We all feel it. Donald Trump could actually be president again, threatening our democracy and freedoms, including a woman's right to make her own healthcare decisions.
Yeah, so we'd reached out to the Brown campaign prior to our show yesterday, hadn't heard back by the time we went on air, and we have now heard back from Sandeep Kashuk. He's a spokesperson for Nick Brown's campaign. This is the quote that he offered when we asked, is it appropriate to run an ad with, you know, saying that Trump is a threat to democracy and our freedom? Sandeep says, political violence is unacceptable in any form. The assassination attempt against the former president and the loss of life that resulted is tragic and shocking, but that does not change the fact that Donald Trump has engaged in actions and made many statements that are a threat to democracy and the rule of law. In light of that, it's perfectly appropriate for Nick Brown or any other candidate to firmly express their concern and commitment to standing up for the people of Washington. So I appreciate the statement, at least, and your acknowledgement that he's going to stand by that kind of rhetoric during his campaign. Now, I will say, we sent a follow-up, actually, in Nicole's initial email where she was seeking comment from Nick Brown's campaign. It was a two-part question. You know, can you defend the use of that verbiage considering the blowback over the last few days? And two, given that he is now focusing his campaign on threats to democracy, is he willing to take a stand against or a position on Attorney General Bob Ferguson seeking to have the Secretary of State break election law? Because it seems like now you've put yourself in that arena, and arguably that commenting on that is way more relevant to the race he's running, is it not? So you have a campaign ad against Trump, threats to democracy. The guy you want to replace as Attorney General just asked the Secretary of State to violate election law on his behalf. So do you have a position on that? Nicole had asked them. That question didn't exist and they didn't respond to it. So we followed up this morning, asked again, can we get a response to that second line of questioning? And the response we got was, we will not be giving comment on that issue. And that's hypocrisy. That is hypocrisy. Either you care, truly care about things that are threatening to our democracy or our democratic process, or you don't. So I'm sorry, I just can't take you seriously when you release this ad talking about Donald Trump's a threat to democracy and we have to stand firm against threats to democracy and we're going to continue to do so. But yeah, the guy who like will probably eventually support my campaign and who I'm trying to replace and who might be the next governor, yeah, no comment on his request that the Secretary of State violate election law. So hypocrisy overfloweth on both sides. It's exhausting, but we must point it out. It is our job, after all. Speaking of Bob Ferguson's Election interference. I'm going to go ahead and call it that. That's their verbiage, right? That's the language of the left. So if you try to interfere in our democratic process, you've committed an act of election interference, which I think Bob Ferguson did. So you might recall a little background here for anyone who's watching who's not familiar. Attorney General Bob Ferguson, there was a stunt by a conservative, Glenn Morgan, to find two other Bob Fergusons to run for governor as Democrats in this election. And Bob Ferguson responded by having a full-on meltdown and asking, directing the Secretary of State to break election law on his behalf to help him out, saying, the Secretary of State needs to move my name up. And in our state, election law dictates that the order on the ballot is selected by random draw. That's the only way that you can make it fair. But Bob Ferguson said, if the other two Bobs don't drop out, I want the Secretary of State to bring my name up or put their name below mine. So break election law to advantage his campaign. The Secretary of State, who is a Democrat, said, I can't do that. Only a first-year law student would think that I could do that. He actually said that. That's a quote from Secretary of State Steve Hobbs. There was a phone conversation between the two of them where Bob Ferguson said, according to leaked audio of Steve Hobbs characterizing the conversation, where he said, bullshit, you can push the envelope. So that's the conversation. Can you imagine if a Trump candidate said to our Secretary of State on the phone, bullshit, you can push the envelope, like telling him to break election law on his behalf? End of the campaign. End of the campaign for a Republican. But for Bob Ferguson, Democrats don't even want to comment on it. So anyway, Mark Mullett, a Democrat who's also running for governor, filed a complaint against Bob Ferguson with the Washington State Bar, because Ferguson's an attorney. You'll recall we broke the news that the Washington State Bar came out in response to that complaint and said, you know, we think we're going to wait until after the election to investigate this thing, which was shocking to me. It's like, this is a complaint that has to do with public conduct, something he said multiple times publicly and privately about potential election interference, and you're going to wait until after the November election to investigate it? So Mark Mullett, as is his right, he appealed that decision, and he wrote them a letter, and he said, look, here's the reasons I think you should investigate it before the election. So the Washington State Bar Association has now made a final determination on what it's going to do, and they are sticking to their guns. They sent a letter to both Mullett's campaign and Ferguson's campaign. I'm going to just read part of this for you, because I think it's just, again, it doesn't make sense to me. It's totally backwards. As a matter of policy, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel defers grievances alleging election-related misconduct against lawyers who are candidates for public office in an imminent election. There is good cause for doing so. Quote, the integrity of elections is essential to the very preservation of a free society. When a lawyer is a candidate for public office, actively investigating allegations of ethical wrongdoing or dismissing those allegations presents a meaningful risk that the actions of the Washington Supreme Court's lawyer discipline system will be taken as condemnation or endorsement of the lawyer's candidacy, when neither is the case. The risk is particularly acute where, as here, both the grievant and respondent lawyer are candidates for the same office. And that acute risk is amplified further where, as here, the election is high profile and any action by ODC might be held out to the public as inculpatory or exculpatory, as the case may be. They went on to say, because what happened in this matter is largely undisputed and because those facts have been reported in the public press and media, there is no rush, basically, here, that such deferral will endanger the public or forfeit ODC's ability to obtain evidence. By contrast, there is a risk that a disciplinary investigation would influence the pending election one way or another, a risk that is entirely avoidable if the matter is deferred till after the election. For this reason, the ODC asks the review committee to affirm its decision on deferral. So this makes no sense to me. When they say, you know, they're using this quote from a case law, Seattle v. State, the integrity of elections is essential to the very preservation of a free society. Like, I agree. And isn't that why you should investigate whether one of the candidates tried to interfere in that election? How is delaying that until after an election when you can't do anything about it? When voters can't weigh what happened and weigh the investigatory outcome and decide whether that's someone they want to vote for? That makes no sense. So they almost think that, they do think, that's what they're saying, that investigating whether a candidate committed election interference before the election is bad for voters. That baffles me. And they're saying that people might take it as as us weighing in on Bob Ferguson's candidacy. Well, yeah, it is kind of weighing in on his candidacy. It is determining whether, as an attorney, he did something wrong. He broke the law. I fail to see you. And one thing I found out of this letter that just came out a couple days ago, obviously we had some other news going on, and so we waited to talk about it till today. One of the things I found that's interesting is apparently Bob Ferguson's campaign also told the state bar, go ahead and investigate before the election. He said. So now you have Mullet who wants it investigated, and even Bob Ferguson, to his credit, said, go ahead and investigate before the election. I don't have a problem with that. So why would you not? Why would you not? And they're saying, nah, we think we'll wait, not only until after the election, until the results are certified, when none of us can do anything about it. So that's just wild. So nothing's going to happen with that until after the election. And then it's up to Mark Mullet to follow back up with the WABAR after it's certified and tell them whether he would still like to see it pursued. Wild system. Two standards of justice. Speaking of election year shenanigans, I mentioned on the show, I think I talked about this on the show. Yeah. So the very first PDC complaint filed against Dave Reichert, Republican candidate for governor, this election cycle had to do with me. I'm very proud of that, by the way. So you guys will know that I do paid speaking gigs often, I would say a dozen or so times a year, to trade groups, to political groups, if they invite me, and I charge them a fee for giving a keynote address. Why do I charge a fee? Well, time is money, takes a long time to write a speech, travel, deliver a speech, and all of that. So yeah, I'm going to charge a fee if some group wants me to come spend my time speaking to them. Happy to do it, but it costs something. Now, I also do an awful lot of speeches for free. I do charity events for free. If it comes to law enforcement, I'll do speaking events and engagements for them for free. So it's really up to me. If I want to charge you, I'm going to charge you. If it's a cause or something, or a person, like a candidate who I support, I'm not going to charge them. And so I have done several events with Dave Reichert, and all of them have been emceeing, so hosting the event, not giving a formal keynote address. When I emcee something, I typically don't charge, unless it's like, there's a lot of involvement, like the Washington Policy Center annual dinner is like meetings, and you're spending a lot of time, and so I'll charge them to emcee that event, because it's kind of much more than that. So anyway, yeah, I do these Dave Reichert events for free at his campaign kickoff in Bellevue. I emceed the event, introduced Dave Reichert, etc. So a semi-Byrd supporter named Eric Crowell, he goes by the handle Outrage PNW, he filed a complaint against Dave Reichert alleging that the Reichert campaign was failing to report my appearances at his events as in-kind contributions. That, so basically, if you're helping a candidate out and you're doing something for them that you normally charge for, you have to list the value of that as an in-kind contribution. But when this complaint was filed, it was obviously like retaliatory because I didn't support Semi Byrd. That's obviously how it came across. And when it was filed, I was like, you can't, the PDC is never going to say, they're never going to regulate the free speech of a media figure. The PDC cannot tell me where I can show up and speak for free or where I have to charge or put a monetary value on my free speech. And as expected, the Public Disclosure Commission swiftly decided that there is no merit to this PDC complaint. They have dismissed the matter without any formal or further investigation, because anyone can file a PDC complaint. The question is it going to move forward into some sort of more formal investigation? The PDC said Cruz does give paid speeches. However, the activities Cruz has participated in for the campaign are not similar to those paid speaking roles, and Cruz does not typically charge fees to MC events or introduce candidates. Due to the facts listed above, there was no requirement for the campaign to report an in-kind contribution from or expenditure to Cruz, being me. So I can keep, he might not like it, Semi Byrd or AG Ferguson supporters, but I have free speech. And if I would like to use my voice to support the candidates of my choosing, the PDC says I can continue to do so. And I will, in fact, continue to do so. Yay, free speech. Lots of drama surrounding this little show of ours. Man, we're just trying to make a difference. We're just trying to do what we can to help the state of Washington.
I think this is proof they're scared of us.
Scared of us. Somebody, I remember back when I first started this show, somebody filed a PDC complaint against me, like accusing me of lobbying. It's like, no, I'm allowed to have political opinions and share those political opinions with whomever I choose. So that PDC complaint was also dismissed. So I am 2 for 2. They're 0 for 2 against me. All right. I have encouraged you guys, if you're trying to save a little bit of money, to have FirstMark Insurance take a look at your current insurance and go shop their carriers and figure out if they could get you better insurance at a better rate. So many Undivided viewers and listeners have done this. I mean, I'm a member of the First Mark family. Nicole's a member of the First Mark family. The show is a member of the First Mark family, and it's because it is an exceptional service. It saved us money, and it takes so much off your plate every single year and trying to figure out, do I have to go and find new insurance? My rates are going up. They're handling it for you for free. You never pay them anything. So take the First Mark challenge today, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. You just set aside a little time. You talk to them over the phone about your current insurance, your insurance needs. They go out. It's about a couple week process where they're shopping the market for you, and they'll come back with their recommendations. Casey in Covington says, I want to thank you for telling us to check out First Mark Insurance. I did the First Mark challenge after receiving a ridiculous renewal statement from my insurance. We made the switch to policies with First Mark and walked away with slightly better homeowners insurance for the same price, and they managed to save us 37% off our auto quote for the same coverage. Right now, every dollar counts. Happy to join the First Mark family. And Casey, welcome to the First Mark family. So take the First Mark challenge today, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right. So on Monday's show, we talked about something happening as we speak called the Freedom from Fentanyl Walk. It's being hosted by U.S. Senate candidate Dr. Raul Garcia, where they're walking from Central Washington to Seattle to raise awareness for the scourge of fentanyl and the lives lost by fentanyl. They're inviting everyone to join if you want to check out. What is it, Nicole? Can you find the website? Fentanylwalk.com. Fentanylwalk.com. You can see where they're at. They also have events where they stop every night. So I have some kind of news I want to share with you after this. But yesterday afternoon, we taped another interview to check in on Dr. Garcia because he'd invited Ginny Burton out with him. Ginny Burton joined him in the Ellensburg area, and you'll know Ginny Burton very well. She was a former addict, had been in and out of prison, spent a lot of time in prison, a lot of time in addiction. And then she managed to find her way out, to scrape her way out of addiction. And now she's working to try to improve the government's response to people who are addicted to drugs. So Ginny Burton and Dr. Raul Garcia checked in with us in Ellensburg. Ginny, where are you guys?
Oh gosh, we're somewhere between Ellensburg and Cle Elum right now.
Oh, so you guys are making great progress. How's it going, Dr. Garcia?
Well, 82 miles so far.
Just a disclaimer, I only started in Ellensburg, so I'm somewhere between 12 and 15. I don't know how many we've done today. So I had a kickoff campaign I had to be at yesterday, so I joined them this morning.
That's why you look so enthusiastic. Ginny, why'd you decide to join the walk?
I joined the walk, Brandy, and I think probably you know the answer, but I have a lot of friends and family that are dying from fentanyl, and we have a lot of folks, I think, that are well-intentioned, that are making rules and decisions around this stuff, but nobody's really consulting with those of us with lived experience on how to address it. And I like to align myself with doers. And so when I met Raul, I realized that we're from the same kind of tribe. And so why wouldn't I join?
Yeah. And he's standing next to you. This is kind of an awkward question, but there are some people who might watch this walk and think, well, that's not doing anything. You're just going on a long walk. What is that going to do to help us deal with the fentanyl crisis? What would you say to that, Ginny?
I would say that I have a lot of supporters that know that every single step my feet take represents somebody that's died from fentanyl. So so I'll probably cry a little bit here, but it means something to me if I'm getting up and walking for it, because at least that's showing that I'm willing to do something, not just pump drugs into somebody and enable them to keep on using more. So we're trying to bring some awareness and say, hey, this is a problem. This is a problem. And this is a guy that's going to do something about it. And together we can redevelop the tools that people are trying to get rid of so that we continue to help people spiral out of control. Like, we're tired of it.
Dr. Garcia, I mean, obviously we both think very highly of Ginny and the important voice that she is in this conversation. If you're elected to the United States Senate, I mean, how could you utilize the experience of someone like Ginny to try to solve this crisis for our country?
Well, I think that we as leaders need to remember that we represent the people, and that those people that have the experience, that have walked a walk already, need to be at the table advising us in what's best for each of the subjects that we have a problem with. And this being the biggest crisis, how could I not have Jenny at the table advising us on how to move forward? We just did a little video ourselves talking about the Americans Against Fentanyl Act and how to make it more inclusive, to include prisons and to better the system. So that's how we become people that bring on solutions. When we sit and discuss this and brainstorm and have different ideologies. So I'm very pleased that she's here, and we're going to make a strong statement.
And Jim, Jenny, you know, we've been, I think after the assassination attempt on the former president, you know, there was all these calls to come together. This is one of those issues that to me is a no-brainer to come together in a bipartisan fashion and deal with. There was a really powerful speech at the RNC from a mother who lost her son who had ingested fentanyl thinking he was taking something else. What would you say to really politicians on both sides about, I think, our shared frustration that they have failed to come together to deal with this crisis?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, we are using a lot of these crises for, you know, political, political gain, really, and convincing people that folks who are just uneducated in knowing how to address these problems, you know, are trying to come to the table and solve something that they have no experience with. And so this isn't a political problem. This is a human problem. You know, we're focusing a lot on things that are going on in other countries when we're ignoring and desensitizing ourselves and our children and telling society to just walk over the war that's happening in our streets. So, I mean, we have, you know, the casualties of the fentanyl war happening on a daily basis. And so we need to open our eyes and call the right people to the table to help with the problem. There is absolutely no shame. There's actually power in saying, you know what, I don't know. Let me talk to somebody that does. Let us collaborate. And, you know, when Raul was talking about, you know, the Americans Against the Fentanyl Act, we have so much alignment. I'm already doing things inside of the prison system here to work towards redeveloping the tools. So we would be idiotic to not partner with each other as human beings.
100%. Dr. Garcia, we'll end with you. You still have quite a ways to go for folks who want to raise awareness to fentanyl, want to get some steps in over the next few days. How can they join you?
Fentanylwalk.com. We have the schedule. Every night we will get together in each of these local towns. So even if you don't want to walk and you want to come and talk to us and tell us about your story and why this is important to you, and give us more to think about, more to bring better solutions, please join us. So fentanylwalk.com. We will be walking into Seattle on Sunday. So definitely we would love to see everybody in that I-90 bridge to make a strong statement to all of King County that we are with them and we are going to clean the Emerald City.
I love it. All right, Jenny Burton, Dr. Raul Garcia, thank you guys for being out there walking the walk and for taking some time to chat with us.
Thanks, Brandy.
Thank you.
All right. So here's the deal. Get the tissues ready. We talked to Jenny and Raul yesterday after the show. We taped that interview. And overnight, early this morning, I was on Instagram and I saw the news that a couple hours after we talked to Jenny, her son had been found dead of an apparent suicide. So it's obviously a really, you know, she clearly did not know it at the time that we spoke. I checked in with her this morning, obviously offered my condolences and, you know, asked her if there's anything we could do for her. I also just said, hey, we can hold off on airing that interview. And she said, you know, absolutely not. She said, I'm, you know, out here. I'm going to do this last leg of the walk. I'm out here for not only the people who've died of fentanyl, but now also out here for my son, advocating for better mental health treatment. And we do know that, you know, drug abuse and mental health issues often go hand in hand in our society. I'll just read the post that Jenny put up. Oh, and I just love this woman. I mean, she is one of the strongest women I've ever met. She's a dear friend of this show. And so my heart is breaking for her today. She said on Instagram, I lost my son last night. My husband found him today. I'm absolutely wrecked. My heart is broken. I'm so grateful that he came home 2 weeks ago to be with his family. He let me love him, hold him, and be with him during these last 2 weeks. My son was cheated out of a good life because of my choices early on. He worked hard to build himself up into something spectacular, and he did. He took a bad hand, and he made it good. Over the years, we have worked on our relationship. There have been times he wanted nothing to do with me. I still reached out, though. Regardless of what he may have ever thought, I have loved my son from the day I got pregnant. He was battling something inside of him that I couldn't help him fix. He did the best he could to overcome it, and he lost his battle. He is free now. My heart is heavy and broken, but today my son is free. I love you, Joseph. From the moment you were born, I knew you were special. This world is a much darker place without you in it. We shouldn't have to bury our children. If you're struggling with suicidal thoughts, please check yourself into a hospital. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. You are needed here on this earth. I will never be able to hug my son again. I love you, Joey. So we are devastated for Ginny. I made her a promise via text this morning, though. She said that what she wants is for people, obviously, to have more awareness for not only substance abuse issues, but mental health issues, and in some cases, for people who are dealing with both. She said she is going to be making that last leg of the walk coming up on Sunday. It's going to start in Mercer Island at 12:45 p.m., so that's Sunday, July 21st. And she wants as many people as possible to join her. I told her on the phone today that I'll be there. I'll be there on Sunday at 12:45. I'll hold her hand. We'll walk together. You can meet if you want to be part of this and now support, you know, Ginny and all the other families who've lost loved ones, both to mental health issues and fentanyl. So Lid Park, 2223 West Mercer Way. 2223 West Mercer Way. We'll gather around 12:45 p.m. on Sunday. And walk the rest of the way into Seattle. So if you'd like to join us, please do so. I'm sure you guys share those sentiments. Ginny has been such a wonderful friend of this show. She's been a fighter for so many people, and she needs us to fight for her now as she's grieving the loss of her son. And we are just simply so devastated for her and for all of those involved. All right. You know, let's go right ahead into Unbelievable, if we can, Nicole, out of that. So minimum wage fight that was fought in Seattle and other cities 10 years ago is now starting to catch up to small businesses who were given 10-year period of time to try to put themselves in a position to be able to keep up with the wage that the Seattle City Council thought they ought to be paying their employees. And it is no surprise that even 10 years later, some of those small businesses are really going to be challenged to meet that high, high wage. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, so take you back 10 years. I was a reporter in Seattle at the time. I remember covering this very, very well, where Seattle was one of the first big cities in the nation to decide to pursue the $15 an hour minimum wage at that point. And what it does is it raises every year based on inflation. But that $15 an hour jump was significant for a lot of businesses. And so there was this understanding at the time, and in order to even get enough people on board to make it pass, that you can't overnight treat large corporations the same that you treat small businesses. Smaller businesses that are operating with smaller margins, smaller profit margins, they're going to need more time to figure out how to do this. Well, time's up, apparently, in the city of Seattle, and now that phased-in period is going to be done for small businesses. You know, for several years, for instance, if it was a restaurant, they were allowed to, you know, it could be a lower wage, but tips could compensate for it. So that was part of, like, making up the gap that wasn't available to larger corporations. So not a surprise that, like, look, and I'll just put it this way. If you were a restaurant 10 years ago and you were struggling to pay, you know, your workers and keep everyone on board at that wage, there's no reason why fast forward 10 years, unless your business has grown significantly, why that challenge wouldn't still exist. And that's what you're seeing. I'll tell you, though, there's a quote in this Seattle Times story that's going to absolutely drive you crazy. I'll get to it in a moment. So the headline from the Seattle Times: restaurant industry scrambles as new minimum wage approaches. It says, now that time is up, and next year businesses with fewer than 500 employees may no longer deduct any tips or benefits from their hourly wages. As a result, wages could go up by $3 or more per hour, by far the largest increase since the law took effect in 2015. The long-planned end to a tiered wage system could mean significant raises for thousands of low-wage workers. It's also sending panic through the restaurant industry and brings yet another hefty political question before a city council that's only just moved into the second floor of City Hall. Many of its members won their seats on the promise of friendlier relations with the city's business world. Now parts of that world are asking the council to slow the final rollout of what may be Seattle's defining political movement of the last decade. So it talks a little bit about how this law works and how it has developed over the past decade, just to give you some background. So in the years since the law took effect, the annual increase in wages has been dictated by inflation. This year, businesses with more than 500 employees must pay $19.97 an hour, while those smaller than that can pay $17.25 so long as their workers make up the difference with tips or benefits. The city's Office of Labor Standards will announce the increase for next year this fall, but what's clear is that for small businesses, the credit for tips and benefits will go away, meaning wages will likely go up by more than $3 an hour. That's double the previous high of $1.50 an hour in 2020 and 2021, and more than triple the average yearly increase. So for these small businesses that have been, you know, they've had to increase wages over the last decade, but they've had the option to offset that with tips and benefits. So now that they don't have that option, this is going to be a huge jump for them year over year. So the Seattle Times spoke to a few restaurateurs about the impact, and they're worried, and I understand why. This is from Amy Fair Gunner, who's co-owner of Portage Bay Cafe, one of my favorite brunch spots in the Seattle area. A little commercial there. She says, no restaurant has this margin, so they'll be asked to seriously change what they're doing or they're going to close their doors. The Seattle Times also spoke to restaurateur Ethan Stoll, famous restaurant owner in Seattle. His businesses offer a preview of what the switch will mean. He exceeded 500 employees for the first time last year, meaning he could no longer count tips. The financial hit, he said, was significant, and he followed it by switching everyone to an hourly rate and adding a service charge to his checks. The reaction among his staff was mixed. For some, it was positive because it meant they earned more on sick days or when taking leave. Others decided to quit over the change. He doesn't have a strong position on what the council should do, but said the issue will force change. Quote, you either have to change the model next year or prices are going to go up astronomically or places are going to have to close down, Stoll said. As for the co-owner of the Portage Bay Cafe, she estimates a $3 increase will increase their expenses by $45,000 a month. $45,000 a month. They have several locations in Seattle. She said, for us, it's a make or break situation, at least as far as operating our restaurants the way that we do. And any sane person, any sane, kind, normal thinking person would understand that this is going to be a difficult situation for restaurants. And the last thing we want is for restaurants to have to close down and fire all their staff as a result. That's where you get into the trouble, right? With the wage and the government dictating, you know, these big increases and big jumps. I mean, $3 an hour per employee is quite a bit. Because what's the alternative? Well, if they can't do it, they'll have to cut back hours or they'll have to lay people off. And is that really what the crafters of this wanted? I tend to think probably not, right? If you're like pro-union, pro-worker, you know, I would venture to guess that a worker would rather be employed at $17 an hour than unemployed because the city forced their employee to raise their wage to $19 an hour. But there's this quote in here from the former president of SEIU 775, David Rolfe, that I can't grasp this way of thinking. He said, they can't claim ignorance. They can only claim that they weren't prepared. He says, these guys got 10 years to get their acts together. And if they haven't figured out how to run a successful business without screwing workers, shame on them. They don't deserve to be in business. That is someone who's never run a business before in their life. That is someone who's never, you cannot make money out of thin air. You cannot make more money out of thin air. You can't, as the Portage Bay Cafe, without raising prices, right, significantly, which is an option, I suppose. But then that's going to reduce the number of people who are willing to go there for breakfast and brunch. So then it's going to even out in the long run. You cannot come up with $45,000 extra a month overnight, or frankly, even in the course of 10 years. So what you're suggesting and what you're saying is that small businesses that operate on the margins, that operate with relatively low profit margins, if they can't come up with a way to increase their monthly expenses to be able to pay an extra $45,000 a month, then they shouldn't be in business. They don't deserve to be in business. That is a that is the way of thinking that got Seattle into this mess. And the that way of thinking that, hey, artificially increasing wages, because my position on this is I do think that you should be able to pay your employees kind of a living wage, so to speak, in certain jobs. But there are other jobs that, I'm sorry, they weren't meant to be living wage jobs. I mean, I hate to put it any other way, but like I look at Starbucks where baristas will protest because they're getting like $20 an hour and it's not enough. Well, Starbucks pays for its employees to go to school to get degrees so they don't work at Starbucks for the rest of their lives, so they can go on and find a career that will pay them a wage where they can afford to live in Seattle. You have free will. If you're working for Portage Bay Cafe and you're not making enough money or they don't treat you right or whatever it is, there are a million different restaurants in Seattle that you can go work for that do pay you what you believe you're worth. And that's how the free market increases wages, is restaurants figure out, okay, what's the going rate to pay a server? What's the going rate to pay a bartender? And then the free market determines that, because if you're running a restaurant and you've got people quitting left and right for other jobs, well, you're probably not paying them enough. And if you want people to stay, you want good people to stay, you're going to have to pay them more. And that's how the free market works. But Seattle says, to hell with the free market. We're going to artificially inflate wages. And then if they all have to just fire people, well, they should have planned better. And you don't understand that that actually in the long run hurts workers. This guy, you don't deserve to be in business. Nicole, let's reach out to this gentleman. I'm sure that he would make a wonderful guest on the Undivided podcast, and we can have a nice, robust debate about economics. Unbelievable, truly unbelievable. All right, if you're in the market to sell your home, I have encouraged you to reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. So there's a lot of uncertainty this year, right? You've got the election and like, oh, what's going to happen with the election and how is that going to increase or decrease rates or impact rates, rather. You had the Fed at the beginning of the year saying we're going to do all these rate cuts. None of them have manifested so far. But one thing, Wes Jones, we just had him in. He said, look, you know, if you're looking to sell your home in the near future, now is as good a time as you might get. You have home prices that are pretty high. The supply of available homes is pretty low, but it is slowly ticking up. And you want to get in there while the supply is low, because that's going to start the bidding wars, et cetera, et cetera. Here's what Wes had to say.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come out, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, what are you waiting for? So reach out to sellwithwes.com. The best place to start is to by using their home value calculator right there on the website to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, how far is too far when calling out free speech, even egregious free speech? I wouldn't, it's hard. Elon Musk says he's a free speech absolutist. On a social media platform, I do think there are some things really on the line when it comes to free speech, incitements to violence, all of that stuff. But generally speaking, I support free speech, even horrible free speech, because this is my job after all. And I'm sure there are people who think that my speech is sometimes horrible. But Libs of TikTok this week has been going scorched earth. If you were on social media this week and you said anything that suggested that you were sad the Trump assassin missed, you probably are out of your job, because Libs of TikTok has probably found you, exposed you, put your picture out there, your post out there, your employer out there, and you're probably out of a job, because they've been going relentless all day, every day. So, look, some of this I'm okay with. Some of it I'm okay with. First of all, anyone who would get on a social media platform and say they're sad that the bullet didn't kill Donald Trump, I don't feel bad for you in terms of like, you deserve what's coming. You ought to know that that is a very horrible statement. You're putting it out there to your social media followers, and there are potential consequences for that. So I don't have an awful lot of like sympathy per se. But in some aspects, I really think Libs of TikTok is going too far with the size of a platform that it has. So if you're, for instance, a school teacher, if you're a public employee of any kind, and you're saying that you're sad that the former president wasn't assassinated, like, I don't want you working for the government. I don't want my tax money paying your salary. And as a public-facing employee or someone who works with our kids in the education system, like, I'm fine with you being named and shamed, and I think you ought to go. If you're working for a politician, you know, we've seen some staffers for Congress members and et cetera, similar things, they get outed, they get fired. I really don't have a problem with that. That's fine. But when you start to fold in otherwise private citizens who said something dumb and horrible to their little corner of the internet and their followers, and someone took it and sent it to Libs of TikTok, and all of a sudden you're out of a job, all of a sudden your face is all over the internet to millions and millions of people that follow Libs of TikTok, that's too far. That's way too far. There's one example that honestly, I kind of broke my heart, even though this lady said something horrible. I'm like, really? Is this where we are going? Is this where the conservatives are going? So there's a lady who works at a Home Depot, for the love. Her name is Darcy Waldron Pinknery. She commented on a post, which I'll show the post momentarily. She just commented on a post, and yeah, she said that she said, too bad they weren't a better shot. So anyway, someone sees this and ends up going to confront her at her job at Home Depot. Here it is.
Are you Darcy Waldron?
Yeah. I was Waldron, yeah.
Okay, from Cayuga. And you think that the shooter should have been a better shot? Is that what you posted on Facebook?
I am at work.
You think that the shooter should have been a shooter, huh?
I am at work.
Yeah, I think that's pretty messed up. Pretty anti-American, if you ask me. As a veteran, I'm disgusted. What have you provided to this country? Huh? I'm sorry. This is ridiculous. You are ridiculous. And I'm making you famous.
I don't like it. I don't like it. Okay, so here's what she posted. So somebody had made a Facebook post. She commented under it, too bad they weren't a better shooter. So someone else had outed her, and then Libs of TikTok shared it, saying this is what she posted on Facebook, and then it didn't take long. Home Depot said, hi, this individual's comments don't reflect the Home Depot or our values. We can confirm she no longer works at the Home Depot. So I'm torn, because she shouldn't have said it, right? And you're responsible for anything that you put out there, and any sane person would realize that if you say you wish the former president had been assassinated and Home Depot or your employer, whoever that might be, sees it, that you might lose your job. But again, I'm going to venture to guess that Darcy doesn't have a whole lot of social media followers, that the people who saw that comment was probably a relatively small group of people. And now it's exploded to millions of people, and people are confronting her at work. She looks like an older lady who's probably retirement age but has to continue to work. So she's working at Home Depot, and now she's unemployed. Is that really worth it? Nicole, have I gotten soft in my old age?
I don't know about that, but I do feel like we're on the cusp of maybe changing whether it's acceptable to do this, because it's been normalized. And
right.
From the times of like back in 2016,
yeah.
When there were protests and like terrible signs
like
of Trump.
Kathy Griffith
Kathy with her dead head.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that was normalized and just acceptable, and almost like you were, yay, they're out there protesting against Trump.
Yeah.
And now we've kind of flipped it where it's gone too far. We've normalized it, and now we're pushing back on that normalization. Yeah. And I'm okay with that. I don't know that she should have lost her job. I think that that was probably a bit much, but maybe she just walked away from it. It doesn't necessarily say she was fired, but she might have just walked away not
yeah.
wanting to work there anymore because people are going to keep coming up to her and doing this.
Yeah, that's possible.
But I think that, yeah, making people think about the consequences. I know locally there was, you know, I think a physical therapist mm-hmm. and then like a DOT worker, I think, or not a DOT, but some kind of state worker. So
yeah,
one that was, yeah, taxpayer funded
yep.
and one that was not. And so, yes, I don't know that a physical therapy office needed a bunch of calls about this.
Yeah.
But again, I'm okay with making it not normal
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, and if you run a business, I also think that's a little different. Like, you're asking people to come, you know, spend mm-hmm. money with you, and you're offering them a service or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so, again, like, you have a responsibility to watch your speech, because then you have consequences. But, like, can you bring back up the post that she made. Mm-hmm. Because when I look at it, when it was originally like a screenshot was taken of it, it had 10 likes mm-hmm. on the original post. And her comment had like one sad facey thing on it. So it's like not a lot of people had seen that. And then all of a sudden, millions of people have seen it. People are showing up at her work. This to me is cancel culture leftist behavior. Yeah. It really is leftist behavior. And I get what you're saying, though, Nicole, which is like, well, like, F around and find out. And Libs of TikTok is sparing no one from its wrath. And so maybe this is a wake-up call in mass to say, like, no, you can't be that vile without having people know what you're really like. And I would, the left would do this, by the way, if it had been on the opposite. Oh, yeah. 100% the left would do this. Cancel accounts culture. Would mm-hmm. would expose people, cancel them, etc. I'm just saying, who wants to be better? Somebody want to be better. I mean, right?
I know somebody on my social media that posted something vile like that. Did I screenshot it? No. Like, no.
But you took a mental note that, like, that person's a little unhinged, right?
Absolutely.
Maybe I won't have dinner with them or something, you know?
Yeah. No.
So I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll on Patreon, Locals, and X what you think, because I know that you often disagree with me, which I love. I said, do you support this tactic? Yes, in every instance. Yes, but not against otherwise private citizens, or no, this is cancel culture. Pretty split, but on Patreon right now, 57% saying yes in every instance. Rick says, in the United States, you are free to express your opinion and your frustration. However, there are often consequences for things you say publicly. I do not approve of firing someone for simply expressing their opinions and feelings, but if you threaten someone's life, whether or not it's someone high profile, that's against the law and should not be tolerated. And I agree with the threatening the life, but I don't think saying, oh, I wish he hadn't missed is threatened. I don't think like even the FBI or the Secret Service would consider that a threat against someone's life. Megan says, consequences for actions. Susan says, First Amendment, you may not like what they say, but they have that right. It says a lot about the person and actions of what kind of person they are. If the company does not want to be associated with that kind of employee, it's the company's prerogative to part ways. And I agree with that too. Like, I'm sure Home Depot, had they somehow seen it without it being public, I don't know if they would have fired her, but maybe had a stern talking to her about, like, you can't wish death upon the former president of the United States. Angela says, it's hard not to cheer for it happening to those actually speaking hate. I just can't help but feel this is more of the same thing, just the opposite swing of the pendulum. That's my concern. I'm glad you said that. So when you start to, so when you get this crazy behavior, right, like the leftist behavior that we've seen cancel culture over the years, one of my concerns has been that the response to that will be, okay, now nothing's offensive. Now no one can get canceled. Now there's no consequences and people just say whatever the heck. And I don't think that's a particularly good society to be living in either. But this is a different kind of swing of the pendulum where it's like the left did it. Now let's do it, too. The left did it. We complained about it. Like, now let's do it and let's be just as bad. So I just have an issue with it. I will say, and I forgot to put this in the sheet, Nicole, but speaking of consequences for behavior, one of the reporters at The Stranger in Seattle, we had mentioned earlier on this week, two reporters from The Stranger sent out social media posts. Essentially, one of them was like questioning why Democrats would defend Donald Trump and say that political violence isn't acceptable when he's like an insurrectionist. The other one, a Stranger reporter named Ashley Nervobrig, she had sent it out a tweet saying, make America aim again. That didn't go over well with the internet. And according to Jason Rantz, a couple other people, The Stranger, actually it was a KOW reporter, The Stranger has now parted ways with her. And I think that the way that they said it is that I don't think they said fired, but I think I was trying to find the verbiage. It sounded like she's no longer employed there. And I don't disagree with that. That's a reporter. And that's somebody who's out there judging other people and is going to send out a tweet saying, make America aim again. So I hold myself, I hold other journalists, people in positions of power, which is what we have, to a much higher standard. And how can anyone take you seriously when you're saying, make America aim again? No news, however, about the other person who didn't make a direct like comment like that. Hannah Krieg, I think her name is, who had scolded Democrats basically for speaking out against political violence after the assassination attempt. So I feel bad for Ashley. I'll have to invite her on the show because we've had some email exchanges over the years about other things, but I certainly would like to give her an opportunity to be able to come on and talk about what happened. I was trying to find the verbiage from the stranger. Oh, here it is. She's been suspended. She's been suspended. So I'm not sure what that means, but suspended seems like she's not actively working at the stranger anymore, wouldn't you say?
Well, that means she might come back, but
we'll see. We will follow up with them. They still haven't responded to our initial request for comment. However, all right, I'm down 40 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. I just had a cousin of mine reach out and say they have their 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan today. And I said, do it, girl. You know, one of the things I always tell people when they reach out to me about the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic and they see like the pictures of my results and how much weight I've lost is I tell them it's not easy. Not a magic trick. It is not a pill. It is not some sort of magic like thing that you don't have to work hard and you can get those kinds of results. It is difficult. The first 60 days, though, I stuck to the program and I lost about 30 pounds in the first 60 days. I'm down 40 pounds total. And the nice thing about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, no prepackaged meals, no counting calories, no strenuous workout routines. They're just teaching you what to eat. They're very specific about it for those first 60 days in the right portions. And then you go on with the maintenance program, which I find to be pretty easy to follow. You can have some days where you just go out, eat what you want, drink what you want, enjoy life. And then you have other days where, yeah, you need to make sure that you're always going back to those core healthy foods and you're maintaining your weight loss in that way. So do what I did, what so many others have done. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team and start your journey to a happier, healthier, and yes, likely lighter you. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, it is Thursday. You know what we do on Thursdays. We check in with my sister in the Sunshine State. It is our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, how are things in Florida today?
Everything is Florida-ing in Florida. It's nice and hot and humid and beautiful day outside. So.
Yeah, things are great in Florida, except for a Florida man who was arrested for threatening to kill President Biden. And I think on the subject of, you know, the attempted assassination against Donald Trump and, you know, political violence is unfortunately part of our American reality. And there's a lot of threats that we don't even hear about unless they're on the news. So what do we know about this one?
So this guy, basically, he was in a mental health facility when he made some of these, when it was brought to authorities' attention. Apparently, he made a few comments. So people at the facility brought it to the attention of the FBI and other authorities. And then they ended up finding some pretty awful tweets, or not tweets, but social media posts that he had made. And I'm just so happy that they're taking this kind of stuff seriously, because, like, a lot of people think that they're kidding when they say this stuff, but it's like, you can't tell the difference between a joke and an actual threat anymore. So this guy was arrested just 2 days after the assassination attempt on Trump, and they took it very seriously. So it's kind of nice to know that they're not like going to be playing around with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and there's a bright line. I mean, you know, you have people all over the internet talking about, which we just discussed on the show, oh, I wish wouldn't have missed or something like that. There's a bright line, though, when you actually threaten violence against anyone, let alone the president of the United States. I won't read the very explicit line that he wrote on social media, but, you know, he clearly said that he wanted to kill him and finish him off. So Patrick Elday, 39 years old, in Florida under arrest for making threats against the president of the United States. I want to talk about voting quick in Florida. So obviously, you know, it looks like if the electoral maps that I've been seeing with estimates, I mean, Florida is going to absolutely go to former President Donald Trump. And right now, Republicans in Florida, when it comes to voter registration, way ahead of Democrats.
Yeah, almost by 1 million registered voters. That's a huge lead for just within one state. I think this has, like, there's multiple things that have to do with this. I think the Democratic Party in general is a little deflated right now, and probably some of them are probably pretty wavering in their opinions and their thoughts on how to vote this year. And then I also think that, on the other hand, the Republicans are pretty jacked up and they are coming out in numbers and making sure that they're going to be registered and ready to vote when it's time.
Yeah, just an idea of the numbers. So Republicans have a 956,000 person lead when it comes to registered voters of their party. Democrats, according to NPR, had historically led in voter registration in Florida, but that changed in 2021. So just in 2021, Republicans finally had more registered voters in Florida than Democrats. And 3 years later, they have a million more. That's insane. It was also a wild scene outside Mar-a-Lago the day, it was actually the night that President Trump was shot. Were you down there, Miranda? Did you go report on the scene at Mar-a-Lago?
I was not. I should be a little bit more boots on the ground for you guys.
What kind of Florida correspondent are you anyway?
There are always people outside of Mar-a-Lago waving Trump flags and in support of Trump. I think that he has that big of supporters that they just show up like sports fans sometimes. They're just always there. And yeah, it was a pretty big scene. I think anything that is headlining about Trump, like when he was indicted, when he was in court, there's people on the streets cheering for him, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, we were talking about fentanyl on the show today and just the drug crisis in general. In Florida, and it's baffling state toxicologists there, they're seeing a pretty sharp decline in drug overdoses and they don't know what to attribute it to.
Yeah, so it's about a 7% decline in overdose deaths from last year. I think it's hard for them to come up with any specific reason why that is. Of course, our attorney general is saying that it has a lot to do with increased police presence, kind of cracking down on like the prosecutional efforts to people who are, you know, overdosing or using. In addition to that, just they have put a lot of money into awareness and making sure people are aware of the polluted drug supply that is coming into the United States. In addition to that, what is that?
Naloxone.
What is the naloxone? Yeah. They're making sure that all these police precincts have a huge supply of it on hand so that they can save lives when they need to.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that that has something to do with it. But then I also read that they think people are smoking drugs more than actually injecting them. And that can be a reason why the overdoses aren't so high. But they don't have they're not in the streets to find those numbers on their own, but they are seeing less people using injections, which is, I guess, better.
The best thing is to not smoke it or inject it. That'll really send overdose numbers down. But yeah, the naloxone thing would make sense if they're trying to find an answer, because they said they still have a significant number of drug overdoses, just not fatal ones. And so if they hadn't really committed to, you know, having a supply of naloxone for first responders, and then they started, you know, adding it and making it sure it was placed, I guess that could explain it as well. So I would love for the explanation to be as simple as fewer people are using drugs, but it sounds like maybe it's not as simple as that. So yeah. Miranda, thank you.
You're very welcome. Have a good weekend.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
You have a good weekend, Miranda. Yeah, 1 million more Republicans registered in the state of Florida to vote than Democrats. You really think about that over 3 years. I mean, the Washington State Republican Party needs to go to Florida, figure out how they did that. They need, although we don't have to do party affiliation until you do the primary election, but they need to go figure out how did you reach so many people. And then they need to go to Virginia, talk to Glenn Youngkin, bring his staff here and help Dave Ryker get elected. So just a couple things. You got to look to where the Republican Party has been successful and figure out how do we bring balance back to the state of Washington. So Florida winning if you're a Republican. But we also talked about, remember the mayor from Miami, Francis Suarez, Miami as a city and the county, Miami-Dade County, had gone to Democrats for years, and then they were able to flip it red, and it just keeps getting redder and redder. And if you've been to Miami, you walk around, that does not scream red city to me. People are, it just doesn't, if you've ever been there. And it's just to me the new Republican city, what it looks like. So anyway, all right. So a lot going on, of course, nationally with politics. I think it's going to continue to develop very, very quickly by the day. One thing that we always do on Thursdays is we take the news of the day and look at what the economic implications of it are. And certainly when you've got an attempted assassination of a former president, when you've got news that the current president might abandon his reelection bid. If you're saving for retirement, you've got money in the stock market, et cetera, what impact is that having on you? Our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital joins us to discuss. So not only do we have an attempted assassination of the former president of the United States, the front runner to be the next president, but now it is becoming increasingly clear that President Biden is probably going to drop out of the race. It seems like all the momentum's in that direction. So how, if at all, has this factored into the market?
You know, it'll be really interesting to see. I don't think that what you're seeing in the market this week, there's been some choppiness. Obviously, you had a pretty significant down day on the NASDAQ, and over the market overall, you had a pretty significant down day or two. But I just, you're so overextended. It's really hard. I think you need to avoid that instinct or that initial reaction to sit there and go, oh, this is the market freaking out because Trump got shot. I don't really think it changes anything as far as the market's concerned. It certainly doesn't disrupt any of the dynamics that have been driving the market. And I will continue to say that the biggest dynamics driving the stock market are low unemployment, meaning there has been no interruption to people putting money into their 401ks every 2 weeks. And that money, more so than ever before, predominantly is going into passive index funds. So just think of that money getting pumped in every 2 weeks, gets spread across the entire market, primarily to the top seven stocks, market go up, right? And then you add to that 6.5% to 7% deficits that we're running. Those are the drivers. So until I see something really disrupt those, or until I see the Federal Reserve take significantly restrictive action or not cut rates as the market is counting on them doing in September, I don't think you're going to see a lot of impact.
So if I'm, like, let's say a few years out from retirement and I'm watching politics through that lens, what should I be hoping for out of the presidential race, if anything? Because the economy is the biggest issue for voters. It just is. I think, you know, public safety and the border is starting to creep up. But there is the prevailing wisdom is that Donald Trump's going to be better for the economy. You know, energy independence, gas prices, inflation, and all of those things. But is it as simplistic as that when you look at, like, oh, I should want Donald Trump to be president because I'm about to retire and that'll just be better for my retirement portfolio? Is that too simplistic?
No, I don't think that it has quite. Look, if you look at what Donald Trump's policies are on taxes, on all these kinds of things, if you are looking purely at the performance of the stock market, everything considered, I think it's really hard to make the argument that Donald Trump isn't going to be your candidate, right? If all you care about is the economy, I think that, you know, another way to look at it is if you really don't like us being involved militarily in a bunch of different skirmishes around the world, same kind of thing, right? I mean, just look at the track records. Donald Trump's probably going to be more your candidate than Biden. So I don't think we want to simplify it and say Biden bad for economy, Trump good. But just when you look at the policy, right? Like, for instance, if Trump gets reelected, you're almost guaranteed that he's going to reinstate the Trump tax cuts, right? That's going to be good for the stock market, whether you like it or not. Now, it may not be good for the deficit, but it'll be good for the stock market and also, quote unquote, good for the economy. So, yeah, I think it's a hard argument to make that he isn't the more market or economic friendly guy, right? But at the end of the day, like I said, I think deficit spending and the Fed have a much larger impact. My biggest question is if I'm interested to see if, now the Fed will tell you no, they will tell you that that who's winning the election or who's leading it will have zero impact on their decisions. They're human beings. The Fed is very much a part of the apparatus, and the apparatus is revolting at the idea of another 4 years of Trump, right? And so what I'm really interested to see is if it looks like, if it continues to look this way, which is Trump looks to be kind of a speeding train at this point. If it continues to look like that, how that will affect Fed policy. That's the thing that I am most interested in looking. If it looks like Trump's going to win, are they going to stay as easy? Are they going to cut it in September? I don't know that. And I don't want to in a premeditative way accuse them of doing that. But I'll be interested to see how that rolls out.
As will I. By the way, Zach and his team at Bulwark Capital, they're having another one of their risk webinars coming up next week, July 25th at 3:30 p.m. And while what's happening right now might not make or break your retirement portfolio, one thing that definitely could if you're close to retirement is the inflationary environment we're in. Can you still afford to have the retirement that you've planned for? They can help you through that. So the inflation webinar, they call it the Silent Portfolio Killer for a reason, is happening July 25th, 3:30 p.m. They're going to talk about that, how to protect your retirement portfolio against risk, inflation, election unknowns, global unrest, rising cost of living, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just, you're going to get so much information. I highly recommend it, especially if you're, you know, within 10 years of retirement, to make sure you're managing your risk appropriately. So don't miss it. Don't miss it. You can sign up right now for free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right, let's get to questions and comments. Shauna had a good thought. A few people on the live feed did about, oh, where do these 1 million Republicans in Florida come from? Washington, Oregon, California. A lot of people moved to states like Florida during the pandemic. Duh, Brandy, didn't even think of that. They got all our sane people. Not all of them. There's still a few of us left. Kimmy Finster with a $9.99 super chat. Thank you. Can you talk about this Project 2025 thing? I keep seeing people post about it on social media. I trust your word to believe if Trump winning will make it all true. Thanks again, Brandy. Sure, we could talk about the Project 2025 next week. Democrats are using that as a talking point. So whenever that happens, be very, very suspicious of it. But we can go over it. Let's talk about Project 2025 next week. But no, Trump being elected does not automatically make this wish list that some conservatives have a reality, in short. On Biden, Joan says, I don't think he has COVID. They're hiding him in the basement so he doesn't speak to anyone. I mean, I saw him walking around after the diagnosis with no mask. So I have to believe that that's a distinct possibility.
Right before, did you see that video of him right before he went and got on the plane? Yeah. He's like in a Mexican restaurant, like, giving hugs.
This close to people who are eating food. I super was like, spreader. Oh, that's not good. But it benefits him. My question about the timeline and the Axios reporting saying he might drop out of the presidential race this weekend is, would you do it like on Zoom? That's kind of a big announcement. So wouldn't you wait till he's better, doesn't have COVID, and can like address the nation? Because that's also going to immediately lead to concerns about, okay, if you can't run, how can you serve? Like, how do you plan to get through the next 6 months? So Christy says, the fact that you have to defend your mental faculties in and of itself is an issue. Just saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now that you have all these previous allies in the media who are questioning your mental faculties all of a sudden also is a concern.
It's really, I just don't even know how they do it. How 2 weeks ago, Barack's like, he can do it. Just
great.
Got
it.
He's got it.
Oh,
it's all good. And then now, okay, maybe not.
Yeah. Calling us calling nothing a deep fakes changed. That like the videos, yeah. Come on. Nothing has changed. On Bob Ferguson and the WABR saying we're not going to investigate him. Captain Cranky Pants says if Bobby was a Republican, they'd investigate now. 100%. And there would be wall-to-wall calls from Democrats for them to drop out, saying it was election interference, completely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think you'd hear maybe more forceful statements from the Secretary of State. I know he's done some interviews, and he has been, like he said, that it was a request that even a first-year law student should have known was against the law. So I commend him for that. But I think Democrats would be losing their mind if it was a Republican. Matthew Cook talking about Dr. Raul Garcia's opponent in the U.S. Senate race. Maria Cantwell, truly a do-nothing senator who's seldom heard from, who gets elected simply on name recognition and having a D next to her name as the only qualification. Some of that's true, but you never hear from her. You never hear from her until election season. Mm-hmm. Every 6 years she comes back around, and that's the only time you ever hear from her. Patty Murray is at least out there. She does press conferences, she does things. She does tours, we've covered her. Maria Cantwell is a ghost until election time. Ginny Burton's son being found dead yesterday, sadly, of an apparent suicide. Christina says, I'm so very sad to hear about Ginny's son, sending prayers for her and her family. Yeah, and I echo that 100%. A couple on the minimum wage issue. Greg Olakis says, it's almost like Seattle City Council just wants to completely get rid of small businesses. Seems like their pockets are being lined by big corporations. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? On naming and shaming, Harold Burns gives us some insight. He says, as a Home Depot employee, I can tell you we are cautioned about our social media posts and how it could impact your employment. And I would imagine most companies do. Right. I encourage Nicole to post questionable things, so go for it. But
okay. I think people forget what social media is, and it is media. It is out for everybody, and that represents you. So, I mean, this is going to be a hard lesson to learn for some people, but this is the truth of social media.
Well, and there's really no, we used to give that spiel to like younger kids, you know, social media is forever. Don't ruin your life by posting something dumb at 17. But like this lady looks 60 or 70, and then all the faces that Libs of TikTok has shamed, it's 30-year-old teachers. It's 50-year-old staffers of Congress members. It's like people have lost their minds. They're so unhinged that they just, it's a moment of anger. And I mean, the mayor of Aberdeen, and they just genuinely do not care in that moment. And then it's like, well, I got caught. Now I care big time. Oops. And it's ruined my life. So Michelle says, I'm okay with these folks who call for acts of violence anywhere to be fired. I don't actually care at all. So Michelle's like, zero F's
Maybe
to give.
Just be a good person.
Yeah.
Can you just conduct your way yourself?
Keep it. No, lock it in. That... Look, I'm a much nicer person publicly than I am in my own mind.
Oh, I know.
In my own mind is vicious, right? So you just take that. You just lock it up. You lock it up. You throw away the key, okay? Deep down inside, or whisper it to yourself. Find a nice little closet, and you go in there and you say, I wish the shooter hadn't missed. I wish the shooter hadn't missed. I wish the...
I didn't even like putting
you,
that
sorry,
out
and then you lock... Yeah, sorry. And then you lock... You say it all in there. You get it out. And then you just... You come out of the closet and you move on with your life, okay?
Guess what? It is not affecting your day-to-day.
It's not. Oh, my goodness. So anyway,
everyone off.
I feel bad for the Home Depot lady for losing her job. I understand people saying, well, she deserved it. Good comments per the usual. And speaking of people who need to lose their job, let's get to our closing sanity check. I thought that there was nothing that could be said on MSNBC that would surprise me at this point. I truly believed that, especially coming from MSNBC host Joy Reid. But she always has a way of surprising me and one-upping herself. Listen.
These two men are both elderly. Donald Trump is an elderly man who, for whatever reason, was given 9 seconds to take an iconic photo op during an active shooter situation. Weird situation. We'll figure that out one day. But his survival of that and bouncing right back and going right to his convention is being conveyed in the media world as a sign of strength. This current president of the United States is 81 years old and has COVID. Should he be fine in a couple of days, doesn't that convey exactly the same thing? That he's strong enough, older than Trump, to have gotten something that used to really be fatal to people his age. So if he does fine out of it and comes back and is able to do rallies, isn't that exactly the same?
It should.
I mean, it's not exactly the same. It's not the same incident, but it's an elderly man coming through out of an illness.
It should.
For the record, regardless of my age, 100% of the time, I would choose COVID over a bullet. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided and a week's worth of episodes of Undivided. We have a wonderful interview. We're debuting our new side set on Sundays with subscribers this week. That's exciting. Took long enough for us to get it done. But we're going to have an interview on a topic from the RNC that went completely under the radar this week. For the first time in their history, Republicans have eliminated from their official party platform any opposition to gay marriage. This is certainly a big win for gay Republicans who have been pushing for this for some time. And so we're going to be joined by a member of the Log Cabin Republicans to talk about what all of this means. So we look forward to having that conversation on Sundays with subscribers. If you have not signed up to support the show already, please do so. It's just $5 a month for this much fun. Love it. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. While you're there, you can shop our Common Sense 2024 collection using the promo code SANITY24, that's SANITY, and the number 24 for 25% off. Subscribers, we will see you on Sunday. The rest of you, we will see you back here on the live show Monday at noon.